On 9/11, it became clear that Al-Qaeda was a national security problem for the United States. We are never going to abolish terrorism, obviously. It's been around for several thousand years. But what we can do is hope that we can manage it back into a sort of second-order threat. That isn't a very sort of tidy definition of victory, but I think that's the best we can hope for.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today's guest is Peter Bergen, a print and television journalist who in 1997 produced the first on-camera interview with Osama bin Laden for CNN. At CNN, he is a terrorism and national security analyst and has traveled extensively throughout the Mideast to report on Al-Qaeda. He is a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation, an adjunct lecturer at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, as well as a senior fellow at NYU's Center on Law and Security. Bergen has written for a variety of publications, including the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post. He has testified before congressional committees, has worked as a correspondent for National Geographic and Discovery Television, and is on the editorial board of the scholarly journal Studies in Conflict and Terrorism. Bergen's books include Holy War, Inc., Inside the Secret World of Bin Laden, and The Osama Bin Laden I Know, An Oral History of Al-Qaeda's Leader, both of which were made into documentaries for CNN and for Discovery Television. Please join me in welcoming Peter Bergen.
Thank you. Christina, thank you also to the Miller Center for this invitation. I'm going to talk for about half an hour today. The title of the talk is Meeting Osama, so I'm going to briefly talk about what it was like to meet him and what he said and how it's relevant today. And then I thought, since we're now at the 7th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, that I would talk about where is Al-Qaeda today, what is the threat level in my view, a little bit about what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also some discussion of what Al-Qaeda is likely to do in the future, and also touch upon some of the strategic weaknesses of Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups, strategic weaknesses that will essentially write them out of history at some point, hopefully in the near future. So first of all, meeting Osama, obviously that was back in March of 97. At that time, the reason that I decided to go and meet bin Laden was I was living in New York when the first Trade Center attack happened in 1993, and it was fairly obvious that the plan to blow up the Trade Center in 93 didn't just involve a bunch of, you know, angry cab drivers from Brooklyn who took it upon themselves to attack the Trade Center. There was some sort of organization that was involved in this. In fact, it became clear many years later that Al-Qaeda had, in effect, an office in Brooklyn at the time. I only was able to discover that when I realized many years later what Al-Qaeda called itself at one point was the services office. And I looked back on my notes of some meetings I'd had in 93 in Brooklyn and found out that they were referring to this place in Brooklyn as the services office, i.e. the same name that Al-Qaeda was referring to its office in Pakistan. So in 93, the Trade Center is attacked. Six people are killed. The idea is to bring down both towers. And of course, that didn't happen that time, but it would happen on 9/11. And since it seemed to me that the group of people involved weren't just a bunch of disaffected cab drivers from Brooklyn, but actually had some organization, when I first heard bin Laden's name in 96, which was the year that CIA opened a bin Laden unit, for the first time in the agency's history that a dedicated unit to a particular individual had been opened at the agency, I said to my bosses at CNN, why don't we go and find this guy, because I think this organization that bombed the Trade Center the first time is led by this guy, Osama bin Laden. And I think he's the person who's actually responsible for the first Trade Center attack. Now, that turned out to be wrong. Bin Laden wasn't really responsible for that first Trade Center attack, but he was responsible for this larger organization. Anyway, so at that time, in 97, late 96, early 97, bin Laden had a media advisor who was basically living in London fairly openly. And I went to talk to this media advisor, a Saudi guy by the name of Khalid al-Fawaz, and said, you know, we want to meet bin Laden. Now, we were not alone in this because other people, the BBC, 60 Minutes, other news organizations were also interested because it was becoming clear that he was perhaps important. The State Department in August 1996 had put out a white paper, quite an interesting one, about bin Laden, saying that he was a significant financier of Islamic extremist groups and that he was running training camps in Sudan and possibly Afghanistan. Anyway, after a certain amount of negotiation with this media advisor in London, I met other people who knew bin Laden, who lived in London. At that time, of course, London was known as Londonistan because there were so many sort of Islamist militants who were living there. And I met a number of them, people who knew bin Laden. And after a certain amount of time, they said, well, you know, we're going to give you the go-ahead, or you go back to the United States and we'll later give you the go-ahead once we know from bin Laden. And about a month later, we got the green light. Myself and the correspondent, Peter Arnett, and the cameraman, a British cameraman, went to Pakistan. Now, the week before we were doing this, the Taliban had banned filming. You may recall that from the Taliban perspective, the filming of living human beings was against Islam, and the photography of living human beings or animals. And so obviously, since we were doing a film project, the fact that they banned filming was going to be problematic. So I decided that we would not get a visa from the Taliban, who were a very disorganized group of people. They wanted to impose a totalitarian state on Afghanistan, but they were extremely incompetent and couldn't really do that. So we went into Afghanistan without visas, which is not something I normally would do. And the Taliban either knew what we were doing and didn't care, or just didn't really find out about it. We went to near Jalalabad in eastern Afghanistan. We waited around. We had another media advisor come. They looked at our camera. They were very concerned. Were we secreting a tracking device in either our gear or on our persons? In the end, they said, don't bring any of your gear. Just bring your clothes you're wearing. And they, at a certain point, a van came, three heavily armed men. They drove us through the night, change of vehicle, blindfolds, more driving through the night, up into the mountains near Tora Bora. Although I was, you know, I didn't exactly know where I was, but retrospectively I realized we were near Tora Bora in eastern Afghanistan. Mud hut, middle of the night, bin Laden appears out of the darkness around midnight. And the first thing that struck me is he's quite tall. He's very tall and very thin. He's something like 6'4". He carried himself not like a cleric, not like a sort of revolutionary table thumping guy that I thought he might be. He carried himself more like a cleric. He spoke almost in a whisper. He was very low key. And the relevance to today is what he said then, because he basically said in March of 97, I'm declaring war on the United States. And we asked why, you know, is it against American soldiers or against American civilians? And at the time he said it really is directed at American soldiers, American military targets. Obviously, this, and that if American civilians were killed in these operations, you know, that so be it. Obviously, Al-Qaeda became more radical over time, and any qualms they had about killing American civilians disappeared. This was all delivered. He's quite well informed. He's quite intelligent. He mentioned at one point, without exactly saying this, he said, you know, who are you calling a terrorist? Jerry Adams, the head of the provisional, you know, the political arm of the IRA, was meeting with Clinton and the White House around this time, and he was saying, you know, A, how many Arabs know who Jerry Adams is, and B, how many Arabs living in Afghanistan in a mud hut? So this is somebody who's quite well informed. He seemed quite intelligent. He seemed very focused. The people around him treated him with a great deal of deference. They called him the Sheikh, term of respect. Most of them spoke English, by the way. A lot of the people that I was dealing with spoke English, which goes to an important point that, of course, the people in these groups are not uneducated or dispossessed. They tend to be empowered rather than, you know, poverty-stricken. And so, you know, and very few of them, by the way, have gone to madrasas, something I'll address maybe in a second. Because there was a lot of discussion about madrasas being a source of all this problem. But if you think about it, a madrasa graduate is essentially a functional idiot who can recite the Quran in a language that he can't understand. This does not get you past customs at JFK or Heathrow. And so when, if you look at the people in bin Laden's immediate circle, almost none of them have attended madrasas. And in fact, they tend to be highly educated. So after bin Laden delivered this sort of tirade against the United States, declared war against the United States, we left, and part of me was saying, well, that was all very interesting, but how do you attack the United States from Afghanistan, you know, from a mud hut? And with the embassy attacks in 98, which was blowing up two American embassies almost simultaneously, it became clear that, you know, Al-Qaeda had an ability to reach out thousands of miles from its base on the Afghan-Pakistan border, and was interested in mass casualty attacks against civilians. One point is, imagine, do the thought experiment where the Japanese high command in 1937, on the equivalent of CNN at the time, RKO or NBC or whatever, repeatedly made statements about how they were going to attack the continental United States or attack the United States in general. Think how Pearl Harbor might have played out differently. So, you know, Bin Laden, it was not a secret. You didn't need a presidential daily brief, as President Bush did on August 6, 2001, entitled, Bin Laden Determined to Strike the United States. Rarely have our enemies warned us more precisely and more often about what their intentions were. So it wasn't a lack of information about their intentions. It was just basically not really accepting that a non-state actor could attack the United States. Obviously, we understand now that that is perhaps the threat we will face in the future, because clearly, Al-Qaeda has merely demonstrated a particular kind of warfare, and there will be other kinds of groups motivated by other kinds of ideologies and other kinds of leaders whose names we don't know, whose ideologies we may not understand. It could be, for instance, radical vegetarians armed with nuclear weapons 50 years from now. I don't know what it will be. It will be something. Because if you go back, Bin Laden founded Al-Qaeda over the course of two or three weekends in 1988. And actually, the minutes of those meetings, which were in my second book, which is on sale outside here, the minutes of those meetings actually were found in Bosnia, in Sarajevo in 2002 in a police raid, and they were then introduced into a court case conducted by Patrick Fitzgerald in Chicago. And these are the minutes of Al-Qaeda's first meeting. So any discussion of, this is a very interesting historical document, but in that document it says, there's nothing about the United States. This was an anti-American group that only really, began to conceive of the United States as its main enemy after its founding. And it was a very small group of people, 14 guys who met over the course of a couple of weekends, who decided to take their jihad skills, which they've been using against the Soviets, and take them to other jihads around the world. The reason I mention this is that this group of a dozen or so men, of course all men, within 13 years of their founding, inflicted more direct damage on the United States than the Soviet Union had done during the Cold War. And so small groups of people can obviously influence history, and Al-Qaeda has provided a model, I think, for other groups in the future, non-state actors, because clearly no one's going to confront the United States other than non-state actors if they want to remain in business. The reason non-state actors, of course, will continue to be a threat is that non-state actors like Al-Qaeda don't have return addresses. They're very weak, but it's their very weakness and lack of return addresses that make it more likely that they will attack us, because no state will obviously attack the United States at this point. So that was my meeting with Bin Laden. Where is Al-Qaeda today? Where might it be 5 years from now? The National Intelligence Estimate, which is the 16 intelligence agencies in the United States, collectively said in 2007 that Al-Qaeda had regrouped and resurged on the Afghan-Pakistan border, which I think is true. And there are five or six pieces of evidence for Al-Qaeda's resurgence. One, the London attack of July 7, 2005, which was the largest terrorist attack in British history, killed 52 British commuters going to work on a Thursday morning. That attack was badly misinterpreted by both the British press and the British media right around the time it happened, as a bunch of homegrown radicals who somehow got it together to do this attack. Well, it turned out that two of the ringleaders of the attack had actually trained in Pakistan with Al-Qaeda. Both of them made so-called martyrdom tapes with Al-Qaeda's video production arm, and this attack was managed and controlled by Al-Qaeda. Looking more broadly at the United Kingdom right now, the head of the MI5, which is the Domestic Intelligence Service in Britain, has said there are 2,000 British citizens or residents that he considers of serious concern to British national security, and that many of the plots that have happened in Britain, both the ones that have succeeded, like July 7, 2001's, at July 7, 2005, and other attacks that haven't succeeded, for instance, the so-called planes plot of the summer of 2006, which the trial of which has just finished. That plot was an attempt to bring down seven American, Canadian, British airliners with liquid explosives in the summer of 2006. That plot was also directed by Al-Qaeda from Pakistan. We'd be having a very different conversation today, obviously, by the way, if that plot had succeeded, because if that plot had succeeded, there would be 1,500 dead British, Canadian, American citizens in seven simultaneous planes blowing up over the Atlantic. One of the reasons that only 4% of Americans think that terrorism is a big concern in a recent poll that came out in the last couple of days is that we haven't been attacked. And in a way, the fact that only 4% of Americans think that terrorism is a really important issue for them is a good thing, because the whole point of terrorism is to terrorize people, and if you're not terrorized, it's not working. If the main concern is, you know, what Britney Spears' weight level is, as opposed to what is Osama bin Laden doing today, that's in a way a good thing. So terrorism as a national, as a threat to the United States, Americans have tended to now discount it, which I think is not an unreasonable proposition, because I think despite the fact that Al-Qaeda can attack in places like London and in Britain, Al-Qaeda has a pretty lively recruitment base. In the United States, it's very, very different. I mean, American Muslims are better educated than most Americans. They're better educated, they have higher incomes, and they don't live in ghettos. Now, take all those statements 180 degrees, and you have the situation of what's happening in Europe, where British Muslims are generally less well-educated than the norm. British Muslim men have enormously higher unemployment rates than the average. A lot of British Muslims live in ghettos. And the American dream has worked very well for American Muslims, but there is no kind of equivalent British dream or EU dream or French dream or Spanish dream or any of these kinds of dreams in Europe. And therefore, these European Muslims are not being integrated. And of course, looking forward in terms of what the threat will be in the future, alienated or homesick or dispossessed European Muslims, you know, a small percentage of them will turn to radicalism. And we saw that in Madrid, we saw that in London. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see more of that in the future. But just returning to the snapshot of where Al-Qaeda is today. So the London attack, July 7, 2005, is Al-Qaeda. What's going on in Britain, a lot of Al-Qaeda plots, according to British intelligence. What's happening in Afghanistan, I think, is partly to do with Al-Qaeda's resurgence. If you look at the suicide attacks in Afghanistan, they only really took off about a year or two after the invasion of Iraq, because to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, who've increasingly morphed together ideologically and tactically, learned how effective the suicide operations and IED attacks were in Iraq, and either copycatted directly from the Iraq war or actually sent people to learn on the job in Iraq to import those techniques back into the Afghan-Pakistan theater. So, for instance, there were one or two suicide attacks in 2002, 2003. There were 26 in 2005 in Afghanistan. There were 136 in 2006, something like 140 in 2007. So an exponentially rising graph of suicide attacks in Afghanistan, which is Taliban importing Al-Qaeda's playbook into their theater. And as you know, the situation in Afghanistan has really gone from not particularly good to worse in the last several months. I've been visiting Afghanistan since 1993, and I'm still optimistic, because Afghanistan has gone through so many different things. The invasion by the Soviets, which left more than a million Afghans dead and left 6 million of them refugees. Then the civil war, where the Afghans themselves destroyed Kabul, the capital city, and then, of course, the Taliban. So if you compare all that history to what's going on right now, it's not surprising that Afghans remain somewhat optimistic about the future, somewhat hopeful, but the glass is it's a glass half full, glass half empty, and the trend is definitely downwards. And I think Al-Qaeda has influenced the Taliban both tactically and ideologically to make the situation worse. Then across the border in Pakistan saw more suicide attacks in 2007 than the entire Pakistani history. There were 60 suicide attacks in Pakistan last year. Again, that's because the Al-Qaeda playbook has been used by the Pakistani militants. And bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two in Al-Qaeda, have specifically said in the last year or two that we should attack, militants should attack the Pakistani state. And of course, unfortunately, their biggest victory was to kill Pakistan's most popular politician, Benazir Bhutto, on December 27th of last year. Another area which I think in terms of Al-Qaeda's strength today is the very obvious fact that Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are still out there. And I believe in a perhaps simplistic view of history that certain people make a very great deal of difference. And just as it's very hard to explain why the French were in Moscow in 1812 without Napoleon, or the Holocaust without Hitler, I think it's very hard to explain 9/11 or Al-Qaeda without reference to bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri. It's their idea, it's their group, and they're still out there. And they haven't become historical figures. If they were just historical figures, I wouldn't be talking about them, because they would be ancient history, as it were. But because they continue to release videotapes and audio tapes, which provides strategic guidance to the jihadi movement and Al-Qaeda, they remain quite important. So, for instance, bin Laden's call for attacks on the Pakistani state recently. That's one of the reasons we have so many attacks against Pakistani policemen and soldiers. Bin Laden has made it official al-Qaeda policy to attack the oil industry in Saudi Arabia. One of the reasons we had an attack February of 2006 on Abqaiq oil facility in Saudi, which is the most important oil facility in the world. If that attack had succeeded, it would be 10% of the world's oil supply out offline. And so the fact that they are still out there and influencing things is of critical importance. And finally, just on in terms of their resurgence, al-Qaeda takes its information operations quite seriously. And al-Qaeda's video production arm, which is called As-Sahab in Arabic, the clouds, last year produced 90 videotapes and audio tapes. And these videotapes and audio tapes are in multiple languages. They have subtitles. They have graphic effects. And it indicates an organization that is able to produce a pretty effective propaganda. Now, the area where al-Qaeda has obviously taken a huge hit, on the other hand, is in Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq controlled very large chunks of Iraq. I mean, Anbar province, which al-Qaeda ran, according to the Marines' own assessment in 2006, is 30% of Iraq's territory. And they also control, good chunks of areas south and north of Baghdad. Their ability to control territory has now gone, but their ability to remain a threat, a spoiler in Iraq's fragile peace remains pretty strong. For instance, let's say al-Qaeda in Iraq bombed again the Samarra Mosque. They could reinvigorate they could start up the civil war again. Let's say they killed Grand Ayatollah Sistani or some other major religious Shia figure in Iraq. They could be a very important spoiler. So that's a little picture of where al-Qaeda is today. Remember, where might they be 5 years from now? Well, I think they have, in the longer term, let's say 10 to 15 years, they have enormous strategic problems. One is they kill a lot of Muslim civilians, which Muslim civilians around the world are noticing. Support for suicide bombing in country after country in the Muslim world is cratering. Support for al-Qaeda, support for bin Laden is dropping precipitously because I think there is a dawning recognition in the Muslim world that the same ideological virus that attacked the United States on 9/11 is the same ideological virus that is producing attacks in their own country. So we saw in Saudi Arabia after May of 2003 that al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia started attacking the Saudi state, started attacking Saudi targets, and the Saudi state and the Saudi public have had a 180-degree turn in terms of their views of their tolerance for al-Qaeda in the kingdom. We saw the same thing in Indonesia where JI, which is Jamaat Islamiyah, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Indonesia, the first wave of Bali attacks in 2002 killed 200 Western tourists. The second and third waves of attacks against the JW Marriott in Jakarta, against the Australian Embassy in Jakarta, and also another wave of attacks in Bali in 2005 killed mostly Indonesians. And so there's been Indonesia, after all, the largest Muslim country in the world. The al-Qaeda affiliate there is basically really almost out of business. And so the first strategic problem is they kill a lot of Muslim civilians, and that is being noticed around the Muslim world. And of course, it's against the Quran. In the Quran, it says you can't kill civilians and you can't kill Muslims. So it's sort of a double whammy in terms of the problem that al-Qaeda has in this issue. The second problem they have is that they've created a world of enemies. I mean, this is never a winning strategy. And I can't think of a category of person, institution, or government that al-Qaeda hasn't said it's opposed to, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese or the Indians or Jews or Shia or Muslims who don't precisely share their views or Americans or the UN or the international media. So they have made a world of enemies. The third strategic problem they have is that we know what they're against. What are they really for? Now, if bin Laden was here and you said, what is your plan for the future? He would say the restoration of the caliphate. Now, in practice, the restoration of the caliphate is something that a lot of Muslims are interested in, but it depends what you mean. I mean, when the caliphate existed, it was the Ottoman Empire, a relatively rational group of people who treated minorities fairly well. What bin Laden means is Taliban-style theocracies from Indonesia to Morocco, and I think most Muslims don't want that. I mean, bin Laden has a 90% disfavorable poll rating in Afghanistan precisely because Afghans have lived through the Taliban. They don't want that again. And so Muslims also have seen, what it was like to be in Sudan under Tarabi or what it's like to be in Iran under the Ayatollahs. And I don't think they want to live in this sort of bin Laden Islamist utopia. And the fourth problem they have is, because it's related to the other three, is they can't, al-Qaeda or like-minded groups can't turn themselves into political movements like Hezbollah or Hamas because they're not really offering anything. I mean, Hezbollah as members in the Lebanese parliament and produces social welfare services, et cetera. It does things for people. And al-Qaeda social welfare service is oxymoronic. There will be no al-Qaeda schools or hospitals, and there's certainly no al-Qaeda plan to, let's say, bring the 100 million men who will need, the Middle East will need 100 million new jobs within the next 10 years, Bin Laden has never addressed this rather fundamental problem. So these four strategic errors, problems that they have, will over time, I think, really undercut al-Qaeda. There is an important caveat, which is terrorist groups with zero public support can still be a big problem. For instance, during the 70s, Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany and Brigati Rossi in Italy, they had zero public support, but they were able to inflict a great deal of terror on the Italian state and people, and likewise in Germany. So merely because they're losing, in my view, the war of ideas and they're losing their popular support doesn't mean these groups are out of business. But it does mean that in the long term, they will be. Now moving to the short and medium term, given what this situation that I've just described, which is a certain amount of resurgence in the short term and in the long term, some major strategic problems, what are they going to be able to achieve? And I think what they will be able to achieve is they will continue their safe haven on the Afghan-Pakistan border for the foreseeable future, because the Pakistani government seems either unwilling or incapable or both of doing anything about it. And absent an attack on the United States that's traceable back to the federally administered tribal areas in Pakistan, or absent an attack in London that's traceable back there, I don't think there's going to be the political will or the popular push for extreme measures to be taken. And Christina was asking me earlier about President Bush's, the news in the New York Times on Thursday, that President Bush has signed a no longer secret authorization for U.S. Special Forces to go on the ground into Pakistan and do attacks against al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Clearly, the pace of operations there has really picked up. But to take out all the different training camps and bases along that border would require something even more substantial than what's going on right now. So I would anticipate that safe haven will continue. I would also anticipate that al-Qaeda in Iraq will continue to exist in an albeit smaller form. Continue, now that they've got a presence there, they're going to be very reluctant to give it up. After all, it's an Arab organization. For them, the Afghan-Pakistan border area is where they're headquartered, but it's ultimately a sideshow. What goes on in Iraq is more important to them in the grand scheme of things. They will also continue to attack Western so-called soft targets around the Muslim world, targets like Western-owned hotels. We've seen a blizzard of attacks of these kinds, a Sheraton in Karachi, a Marriott in Jakarta, a Hilton in Egypt, three American-owned hotels in Amman, Jordan. Needless to say, these are a bunch of rabid misogynists, but for tactical reasons, they're increasingly going to use female suicide attackers. We've seen more than 20 female suicide attackers in Iraq. The first attacker, by the way, was a female Belgian baker's assistant. Muriel de Gork was her name, November 9th, 2005, age 38. She'd converted from Catholicism. How do you profile, by the way, for a 38-year-old female Belgian baker's assistant? I mean, you can't. So more use of female suicide attackers, more attacks on Western targets, also more attacks on Israeli and Jewish targets. Again, needless to say, a very anti-Semitic group of people. Before 9/11, they never really attacked Israeli or Jewish targets. Since then, we've had attacks on synagogues in Casablanca, Tunisia, and Istanbul, an attack on an Israeli-owned hotel in Mombasa, Kenya. So I would anticipate more of these. What are the kinds of attacks that they might do that they have tried to do in the past and have not succeeded? One kind of attack, which I think is quite plausible, is bringing down a commercial jet with a surface-to-air missile. The reason I think that's plausible in the next 5 years is they've tried to do it before, and they almost succeeded. At the same time that they attacked the Israeli-owned hotel in Mombasa, Kenya, they tried to bring down an Israeli charter jet with a surface-to-air missile, and it almost succeeded. Needless to say, demonstrated ability by terrorists to bring down commercial aviation would have a rather large effect on the global tourism and aviation business. The second quite plausible thing that they could do is detonate a radiological bomb in a major European city. Again, past performance suggests that they're very interested in these kinds of attacks. Detonating a radiological bomb wouldn't take, it's not a nuclear weapon, of course. It would be a weapon of mass disruption, not a weapon of mass destruction. But to people who weren't sort of necessarily so clued up on it, it would appear that they had moved there was a 9/11 style event. Even though a radiological bomb wouldn't kill a lot of people, it would seem that they'd taken the attacks to another level. In the next 5 years, the likelihood of their being able to attack the United States is, I think, incredibly small. When I say they, I mean al-Qaeda, the organization that attacked us on 9/11. I'm not saying that there might not be a small bore domestic terrorist attack inspired by al-Qaeda, But we know what those kinds of attacks look like. They don't necessarily kill a lot of people. They're not national security problems. Why won't Al-Qaeda be able to attack the United States? I think there are four factors. One is Al-Qaeda is weaker than it was on 9/11 still, even though it's resurging. Two, the American Muslim community has completely rejected the Al-Qaeda ideology. Three, I can't prove negatives to you, but I don't believe there are Al-Qaeda sleeper cells in this country. If they exist, they are so asleep, they're comatose or dead, they've done nothing. And in the absence of evidence, I don't think they exist. And also, the final point, of course, is much harder to get into this country now. And if you look at the terrorist attacks by jihadi groups that in the past, the first Trade Center attack in 93, the attempt to blow up Los Angeles International Airport in December of 99, and 9/11, everybody involved in those attacks came from outside. No one who was here helped the 9/11 hijackers. Anybody who helped them here didn't know what their plan was. Similarly, the Los Angeles attack was planned by an Algerian guy called Ahmed Rassam, who was arrested at the Canadian-American border with a lot of explosives in his trunk. You may remember there was some discussion at the time, was he going to bomb the Space Needle in Seattle? It turned out that his real plan was to blow up LAX in the middle of Christmas. This was an attack that came from outside. And similarly, with the first Trade Center attack, the leader of that attack came from Pakistan. So it's very hard to get in the country if, as you know, there's several hundred thousand people on no-fly list. So if you can't get in and you don't have people here, and people here aren't signing on to the ideology, how do you have an attack? So that's the good news, I guess. Let me conclude by saying that, I guess, you know, one question would be is, how do we know when we're winning, or how do you define victory? I think victory would certainly involve you not coming to this kind of lecture, because it's no longer a subject of any public interest. And in a way, that maybe, on 9/11, it became clear that Al-Qaeda was a national security problem for the United States. We are never going to abolish terrorism, obviously. It's been around for several thousand years, one form or another. But what we can do is hope that we can manage it back into a sort of second-order threat. A second-order threat where it is a problem, but it is more of a nuisance than a national security problem. That isn't a very sort of perhaps tidy definition of victory, but I think that's the best we can hope for. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much, Peter. In a few moments, I'll head to the back of the room to begin taking questions. So I invite anyone who has a question to please line up in the back. But let me begin by asking, some analysts, including Mark Sageman, have made the claim that Al-Qaeda has become a leaderless jihad. And in a recent Time magazine article, you counter this claim, stating that Al-Qaeda is centralized on the Afghan-Pakistan border, as you've discussed, and that, in fact, bin Laden continues to provide some strategic guidance to the organization, and that whatever leaderless jihad does exist will take instruction from this central command, so to speak. I was hoping you could comment on this a bit further.
Yeah, so Mark Sageman is a friend of mine and is a very capable analyst, a former CIA case officer and a forensic psychiatrist. He wrote a very good book called Understanding Terror Networks in 2004, in which he did really the first scientific look at, okay, who's joining Al-Qaeda. And as I mentioned earlier to you, all this discussion about madrasas, I was very suspicious of, because everybody, I met a lot of people in Al-Qaeda and none of them being to a madrasa. And so Mark Sageman looked at the people who were in Al-Qaeda or its affiliated groups and found that, many of them were married and the average age was 26, many of them had college educations, et cetera, et cetera. It turned out that the question about who joins Al-Qaeda, it's a very similar profile to perhaps somebody who might go to a university in the United States. And in fact, many of the key leaders of Al-Qaeda have studied in the United States. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the operational commander of 9/11, studied engineering in North Carolina. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Youssef, his nephew, who bombed the Trade Center the first time, studied engineering in Wales. So before I make a critical comment about Mark Sageman's new book, I wanted to say that he'd done this incredibly useful piece of work before. His new book is called Leaderless Jihad, and the thesis is the threat from Al-Qaeda Central is basically over, and the new threat emerges from people who are sort of self-starting homegrown radicals. I think there are two problems with that idea. One is, if the threat has really come from some self-starting homegrown radicals, I don't think there's any threat. Because leaderless organizations almost by definition don't achieve anything. Let's say do the thought experiment where there were no leaders in the US military. I mean, the US military wouldn't be effective. Do the thought experiment where the University of Virginia had nobody in charge. Maybe it does it have people in charge? Sorry. but so leaderless organizations don't achieve things. And if the threat is really now from just a leaderless jihadis, I don't think it's a big problem. But I think the other part of the problem is that Al-Qaeda Central is actually an organization that continues to exist on the Afghan-Pakistan border. And what's worrisome is when leaderless jihadis, self-starting homegrown radicals, like the British leader of the July 7, 2005 attack, he got radicalized in Britain, but then he traveled to Pakistan, got training from Al-Qaeda, and then conducted the largest terrorist attack in British history. So it's a combination of the fact that Al-Qaeda Central is still there, and the fact that there are people who are self-starting radicals, and then it's a combination of them going to Pakistan and getting training. We don't train the US military over the internet. We train them in training camps. And what you find that effective terrorists have either been in war zones or have gone to training camps. People sitting around in their pajamas reading stuff on the internet, it may get them radicalized, but it doesn't turn them into effective terrorists. You can download every bomb recipe in history. That doesn't mean you're going to actually do anything other than either blow yourself up or create a dud. You really need to go to a training camp to get the kinds of things that require to make you effective.
I was also interested in some of bin Laden's early influences. In your book, you mentioned Abdullah Azzam as one of his early mentors, and how significant the split was between the two of them in terms of their different interpretations of jihad. Could you also comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, one way to comment on it is one of the most significant things that has happened since 9/11 is that a lot of the bin Laden's major figures in the jihadi movement have turned against bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Abdullah Azzam was sort of one of bin Laden's spiritual mentors. He died in an assassination in Pakistan in 1989, but his son-in-law, who is a major figure in the jihadi movement, fought in Afghanistan for a decade, has very publicly turned against bin Laden himself. It doesn't matter what moderate Muslims, whatever, I'm never really sure what moderate Muslims is supposed to mean anyway, but I mean, what is gonna be persuasive in all this is what people who fought with bin Laden or clerics who are quite anti-American who are turning against Al-Qaeda. My view about how we win this, the idea that somehow we're going to persuade everybody that we're great, I think is not the way forward. What we need to persuade people is that the other ideas are bad. And we may have very little role in able to persuade people about this because there's a kiss of death problem out now with the United States. If we get involved, we can't really get involved in a lot of these discussions. But the fact is that leading radical clerics in the Muslim world and people who fought with bin Laden are now publicly critiquing him, including members of Abdullah Azzam's own family, who was this very important spiritual influence on bin Laden. So that to me is the way forward. Can the United States get involved in these discussions? The answer is no, not really. A, the kiss of death problem, B, the lack of knowledge problem. We can't really get into an arcane dispute about Islamic theology. But I think in terms of them losing the war of ideas has certainly been lost, beginning to be lost by them.
Returning to the border question, we have in Afghanistan a complicated situation, which is supposed to be a multinational effort. And there are multinational troops there. On the other hand, when President Bush authorizes the incursion into Pakistani territory, that seems to be a United States decision. Can you comment on the cooperation or lack of it between the U.S. and what it wants to do when what the countries that are supporting that effort in Afghanistan are willing to do?
Well, as you know, when the United States was attacked on 9/11, NATO, for the first time in its history, invoked Article 5, Article 5 being the right to collective self-defense. So there was very little debate, and no debate in NATO, about the fact that the Afghan war was an appropriate war. The problem is NATO has now taken over most of the operations in Afghanistan, in basically the north, west, and south of the country. And NATO countries aren't really very, with some honorable exceptions, are unwilling to get engaged in the fight. And there's some very good historical reasons for that. I mean, the reasons the Germans won't send their troops into combat is because They've had a small history with military adventurism that they don't want to repeat. And so most European countries in NATO are not able to participate in any meaningful way in the fighting. They have something called national caveats, which means they won't do things or can't do things. And I think that any fair-minded observer of what's going on in Afghanistan would have to say that the NATO effort has been a strategic failure, which is very unfortunate. Because from a political and financial point of view, it's great that we have a real alliance in Afghanistan. But I think we need to move forward, and I think General McKiernan, who's the new U.S. military commander, is going to be the combined U.S. military commander and the NATO commander, and he's going to, I think there's going to be more unity of effort, which is what you need to make Afghanistan work. Our cross-border incursions into Pakistan are unilateral. I'm sure they're not being done with consultation with our allies. And of course, it's a very tricky thing because most Pakistanis are very opposed to American soldiers on the ground in their country. It is a sovereign country. Yet it's a country that doesn't seem to maintain sovereignty over its own territory because the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are headquartered on its western borders. So if we go into Pakistan and we kill a lot of civilians, you know, that provides a recruitment tool for the Taliban. On the other hand, if we don't do anything and let Al-Qaeda and the Taliban flourish in the federally administered tribal areas, we're going to have an even bigger problem in Afghanistan. So there isn't a really perfect solution to this except having extremely good intelligence. One note, by the way, the United States has done 7 missile strikes into Pakistan in the last 6 weeks, which is twice as many as it did throughout the whole of 2007. So in addition to the special forces who went in about a week ago, there are now a very intense campaign of hellfire missile strikes into Pakistan. And clearly this is a change. But I think it reflects a great deal of frustration amongst U.S. military officials, amongst the Bush administration, about what they see as Pakistanis' unwillingness or inability to really deal with this problem.
Do you believe that if bin Laden was captured or killed, that would be the end of Al-Qaeda, or do you believe that it would be like a Hydra? In other words, if bin Laden were killed, someone else would take his place?
Yeah. You know, as I sort of mentioned earlier, I believe that certain people are important. And I mean, if von Stauffenberg had killed Hitler in 1944, World War II would have ended a year early. And millions of people would be alive who subsequently died. So, of course, bin Laden is not Hitler or anything like that, but you can't underestimate the importance of particular people. And if bin Laden magically was captured or killed, which I think, by the way, is incredibly unlikely for the foreseeable future, and he's only 51, and now that I'm about to be 46, I think of him as a relatively young man who's done quite a lot of damage given the fact that he's not suffering from any life-threatening illnesses and could continue to influence events for the foreseeable future. But, you know, capturing or killing him would be an enormous psychological victory for the United States and its allies and a major non-psychological victory for Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And no one could take his place. The number two in Al-Qaeda is Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is not well-liked by most of the people in the group. He's seen as a divisive figure. People love bin Laden. I mean, that's a very strong verb, to love somebody. And he is loved by people in his group and by people who aspire to be in his group. So I think if he wasn't around, the group would sort of, he provides a central focus, let's put it that way.
That was the main part of my question as well, but I wondered if you would comment on why you believe that bin Laden has been unable to be either captured or eliminated in any way.
I mean, finding one person is very difficult. In 1993, when the United States had 20,000 soldiers in Somalia looking for Mohammed Aidid, the anti-American Somali warlord, we never found him, and we knew he was in Mogadishu, which is one city. It took 15 years for the Israelis to find Eichmann after the Holocaust. It took more than a decade to find Radovan Karadzic after the alleged Serbian war criminal, and he was in Belgrade, living somewhat openly. So, you know, people stay on the most wanted list in this country for decades. Whitey Bulger, who's allegedly killed 20 people in Boston, has been on the run since 1999. No one's found him. So, you know, finding bin Laden is not going to be difficult. It's not going to be easy. And by the way, We know he's in the Northwest Frontier Province, which is like saying, I know somebody's in Virginia. It's roughly the same size. It's not a very useful piece of information unless you give somebody a more, you know, precise address. So finding Bin Laden is, and also he's not making obvious errors. People aren't going to, people in his immediate circle aren't interested in cash, rewards. He's not talking on his phone. So there's no signals intelligence. So, you know, he could be out there for quite a long time.
Thank you for speaking with us today. My question is about Al-Qaeda's ability to recruit new members and how successful you think they're going to be in this day and age.
Well, I mean, the members they value are people who are going to conduct suicide operations or are willing, they value people who will actually join the organization a lot more than they value people who support them. How easy is it for them to recruit? You know, I mean, easy enough because, you know, you don't need a large number of people to inflict a lot of damage. After all, it only took 19 hijackers to do 9/11. In a way, it doesn't really matter that much. If they can recruit, they don't have to recruit a large number of people is what I'm saying. The actual members of our number of people in Al-Qaeda itself, the core organization who've sworn a religious oath of allegiance to Bin Laden, is maybe 200. Small groups of people can do a fair amount of damage. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, for instance, the suicide attackers were almost all foreigners recruited by Al-Qaeda. They did 90% of the suicide attacks. They killed at least 10,000 Iraqis, and yet the numbers of suicide attackers, you know, probably like 800 people. So, you know, if you can recruit 1,000 people, you can, in Iraq, for instance, you can kill another 10,000. So I'm not convinced that that they don't need to recruit that much to do a fair amount of damage, is what I'm saying.
What do you say is the level of cooperation between Iran and Al-Qaeda, if any?
The role of Iran and Al-Qaeda cooperation, there are some senior members of Al-Qaeda who are living in Iran under some form of house arrest. Iran almost went to war with the Taliban in 1998. Because Taliban killed 9 Iranian diplomats in northern Afghanistan. So there's no love lost between Iran and the Taliban. On the other hand, you know, U.S. officials have said that Iran is giving, you know, some form of weaponry to the Taliban now. I don't think that's particularly large scale as it is perhaps in Iraq. But Al-Qaeda in Iran, you know, Al-Qaeda admired Khomeini in Iran because he showed that you can do an Islamist takeover of a secular state or a nominally secular state. But at the end of the day, Al-Qaeda thinks that Shias are heretics. And of course, you know, Zarqawi, Al-Qaeda's leader in Iraq, killed tens of thousands of Shia. I don't think there's a very strong relationship, both for historical reasons and also just the facts that I played out.
Peter, a number of civilians have gotten close to Osama bin Laden. The time at which you were able to penetrate the circle is obviously a much different environment than what we are seeing today. But in the past several years, the young man who Rafi Khachaturian profiled as Osama the American, and John Walker Lynn, and perhaps others, have managed to basically walk in and get accepted into the Osama bin Laden inner circle. If these people, who are unskilled in many respects, have been able to get so close, why has the intelligence community experienced such difficulty?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, Adam Gadan, the American from California, and John Lynn, the American also from California, both Lynn was, you know, went to Bin Laden's lectures, which he apparently found rather boring and fell asleep in. And Gadan is a very much part of Al-Qaeda's inner circle, although there is some speculation he may be dead now. Yeah, so how is it that Americans could penetrate Bin Laden's inner circle? Well, it shows that it can happen. But why hasn't it happened? Why can't the, pardon me, U.S. intelligence agencies do it? I mean, part of it is linguistic, part of it is cultural. My understanding of the background check now, you know, a disqualifier to join an American intelligence agency, do you have foreign friends or how much time have you spent in foreign countries? And so you end up with a lot, you know, disproportionately high number of Mormons because they speak another language, usually because of missionary work, have traveled in other countries. But you know, probably a Mormon is not going to be able to penetrate al-Qaeda very effectively. And so the fact is that we're not recruiting the right kind of people because we've actually made it harder. I actually think we've made a big mistake here because the whole intelligence community is set up in a sense with a Cold War construct, that there is a vast opposition with enormous amounts of resources trying to penetrate you. Al-Qaeda, you know, doesn't have, you know, an espionage unit directed at the United States in the way the Russians did. And so Jane Harman, who's on one of the Homeland Security subcommittees, the intelligence subcommittee, is, I think, advocated, and others have advocated, that we should have clearances, you know, different levels of clearances, so that we can get people in the system. Because obviously the kinds of people who are going to do what you're suggesting, and not even, you know, meeting bin Laden may be too high a bar, but penetrating one of the groups that is affiliated with al-Qaeda, that's plausible. But to get, you know, that the kind of person who's able to do that has got to be able to speak Uzbek and appear like an Uzbek, or it's got to be able to speak Arabic as a fluent. So, you know, we're still not at the point. You know, there are only 33 there are 33 people in the FBI who can speak any form of Arabic at all, and there are only 12 who have fluency. So that's where we are. This is 7 years after 9/11. I think this is, you know, it's problematic.
I was wondering if you could address a little more fully the costs and benefits of cross-border raids into Pakistan. If, as you are saying, that the al-Qaeda is losing support as a result of many divergent reasons that you've outlined here, does it make sense for the United States to undertake initiatives that are likely to provide more support for the Taliban and indirectly for al-Qaeda in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, that's the dilemma. I mean, if you accept the idea that these groups have enormous strategic weaknesses, then containment and doing no harm should be part of the strategy. However, you know, they are also plotting to attack us, so you can't just do nothing. And they are, of course, you know, affecting what's happening in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not an accident that more American soldiers are dying in Afghanistan now than in Iraq. So it's a dilemma. I mean, you go in, you kill civilians in Pakistan, you're definitely providing recruits to the Pakistani Taliban. There's no doubt about it. And you're making the United States, even less popular in Pakistan than it is already. On the other hand, if you do kill a member of al-Qaeda in one of these cross-border raids, which has happened, two important leaders have been killed in the last 6 weeks, the Pakistani government can kind of live with that. And then the other part of this is that, you know, intelligence is not perfect information. And, you know, you can go in thinking you have good intelligence and you don't. So that is the dilemma that American policymakers face. We can't, you know, Kiani, who's the head of the head of the Pakistani army, on Wednesday said that if there are American soldiers' boots on the grounds in Pakistan, he almost said this would be a sort of casus belli. I mean, I'm not quite sure what he was trying to say, but they're clearly enormously angry about it. But, you know, from a U.S. point of view, can we just sit around and just do nothing? If they won't take care of business, which they don't seem to be capable of or willing of, then we will. And I'm sure that's the message. Look at Mike Mullen. He went out and spoke to Kiani, the head of the Joint Chiefs. He had a meeting with Kiani on the Abraham Lincoln last in July. I mean, I'm sure there have been a lot of high-level discussions with the Pakistanis, and I'm sure, I don't know what they were about, but I've got to presume we are running out of patience, and if you won't deal with this, we're going to start dealing with it ourselves.
Okay. Based on your studies, I was wondering if you could comment on the economic considerations that bin Laden and al-Qaeda might have. You know, religion could be used to recruit, but if you say the folks right around him are all educated, I was wondering if there were economic considerations. For instance, the U.S. relationship with the Saudi monarchy and oil, does that enter the picture?
Well, I mean, it's not an accident that so many of the people, recruits from al-Qaeda, come from authoritarian Middle Eastern countries. And clearly, you know, if there was more political space in these countries, perhaps the attraction of the radicals would be smaller. I'm not convinced that this is that. You know, there's all sorts of reasons to eradicate poverty and to make people smarter, but if eradicating terrorism shouldn't be part of it, because smarter, more educated people are more likely to engage in terrorist acts than stupider, less well-off people. And we know that from history. I mean, the anarchists in Russia were middle class. the Brigati Rossi, the Badr Meinhof. Terrorism is a bourgeois occupation. It's not a, if you're poor, you have more pressing things to do with your time. So it's not about poverty. It may be about underemployment, because a lot of these countries in the Middle East over-educate people who then end up being taxi drivers. I mean, Mohammed Atta, the leader of the 9/11 attacks, had a doctorate, ironically enough, in urban preservation from a German university. Now, if he went back to Egypt, he would be probably be a cab driver. So there is something about the social circumstances is part of it. Repressive regimes, underemployment, lack of opportunity, but it's not really about poverty per se.
Has the U.S. use of torture and secret prisons and Guantanamo done anything to perhaps extend the ability of Al-Qaeda to recruit and maintain soldiers?
I mean, certainly they use Guantanamo as a kind of principal talking point. I mean, if Guantanamo didn't exist, they would have other talking points, you know, Guantanamo, of course, needs to be closed. President Bush has said needs to be closed. Obama has said it needs to be closed. McCain has said it needs to be closed. And it needs to be closed, but it's kind of complicated to do. It's not just something you can just do like that. However, I mean, I think Guantanamo was a moral failure, intelligence failure, enormously counterproductive, extraordinary renditions where we take people to other countries where they can be tortured. You know, it's just un-American. we're gradually, the pendulum is swinging back. Guantanamo will be closed. The CIA has said they will, as of 2003, won't use waterboarding. Where a lot of people, you know, the U.S. government won't have rebelled, you know, internally. I mean, so one of the, look at Guantanamo, the people who have done some of the best work are the military lawyers assigned to the defendants. So, I mean, I think the pendulum is definitely shifting, and we need to, you know, regain the moral high ground. And then the thing that is most damaging to us is the charge of hypocrisy. I mean, if we go around claiming sort of freedom and democracy, and then we're sort of waterboarding people in secret prisons, I mean, it's a sort of a disconnect. And that, it's hypocrisy that, there's very good polling data on this in the Muslim world. It's hypocrisy that is particularly annoying to people.
Recently in Bob Woodward's book, he mentions many elements that contribute to the perception of the surge working, and he declined to name some either technological or innovative things, perhaps including the Predator and drone. And clearly anything that's working there would likely have some increased effectiveness in Afghanistan. Would you take a stab at what he declined to explicate there? And secondly, yeah. Do you see any evidence of Al-Qaeda using exploiting vulnerabilities in our GPS system vis-a-vis air safety, rather than an actual bomb threat, but a GPS wild card?
Okay, yeah. Let me try and answer the first one. We've got 2 minutes. Bob Woodward in his book said the surge was one of, wasn't the most important factor, and he said that for the turnaround in Iraq, and he said that certain secret things made the difference, and I think it's pretty obvious the secret things you mentioned, the Predators, the drones, fusing human intelligence with signals intelligence and overhead imagery. That's what it is. I mean, we've got a much better fusion. But I think, you know, just to finish on Iraq, the surge has been incredibly politicized. The surge, in my view, was a factor, but one of maybe five or six why the violence is down in Iraq. The Sunni awakenings, which long preceded the surge, the Sons of Iraq, which are on our payroll, we are paying 100,000 Sunni militants who used to be shooting us, who are now on our payroll. That's a surge. The Iraqi army is enormous compared to the Afghan army. There's 550,000 members of the Afghan police and army compared to a third less in Afghanistan, which is a much larger country, much harder to control, much harder terrain, larger population. Maliki, the leader in Iraq, who no one could say a good thing about, has turned out to be a somewhat effective leader. Muqtadir al-Sadr, because of his own weaknesses, suggested to his militias they needed to stand down. There have been a lot of underlying factors for the violence in Iraq to come down. Better counterinsurgency doctrine, General Petraeus. I mean, the list goes on and on. So the surge is one part of a much larger picture about what's going on in Iraq. And that's good news, because if it was just about the surge is over. These underlying elements have to continue. That's where we'll get to a sort of stable state in Iraq.
Peter, we thank you for helping us understand a complex organization and an individual that's been very elusive to the American public.
Thank you.
Thank you.